Well, I'm going to speak from the basic proposition that conservatives can govern. Although there is some recent evidence, I freely admit, to the contrary. Let me offer as proof of this assertion some accomplishments of conservatives in three quite different decades. Okay, let's go back to 1948. President Truman achieved an historic upset victory by running not against his opponent, Thomas E. Dewey, but against what he called the do-nothing 80th Congress. The do-nothing. But what, in fact, did that Congress, with its Republican majority, accomplish? Number one, a reduction of 7.5% in federal spending. Now, that's not in the growth of spending. That's outright cut in spending itself, 7.5%. Number two, a cut in personal income taxes with reduced rates by 10.5% at the top and removed 7.5 million people in the lower brackets from the rolls. Three, passage of the Taft-Hartley Act, which redressed a labor management imbalance that had been around for over a decade. And four, passage of the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan, which were basic building blocks in the policy of containment against communism. And yet Truman convinced the people in his election campaign in the fall of 1948 that the 80th Republican Congress had done nothing. Why? Because Republicans, led by their presidential candidate, Mr. Dewey, did not bother to rebut Truman's false charges. Robert A. Taft, who was the leader of the Senate and of that wonderful Republican 80th Congress, was very concerned, and he urged Dewey, who was the nominee, hit Truman hard every time he opens his mouth. That was Taft's urgent advice and recommendation to Dewey. But a complacent Dewey responded that over the years he had found that when he got into controversies, he lost votes. So to avoid controversy, he did not get into an argument with Mr. Truman. And as a result, lost that election. Well, keep those facts in mind. We'll come back to them in just a minute. Let's go now to summer of 81. President Reagan signed the Economic Recovery Act, which Ken has already made reference to, which cut all marginal tax rates by 25%, index tax rates, to offset the impact of inflation. As we know, within a year, that stagflation, or a little more than a year, created by President Carter and his policies, had disappeared. An unparalleled period of economic prosperity and growth began, which is still continuing today, some 17 years later. In 1982, President Reagan told the British Parliament at Westminster that the march of freedom and democracy will leave Marxism-Leninism on the ash heap of history. Very skeptically received at the time, in the early of 1982, but he was right. Just 7 years later, after challenging Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down the Berlin Wall, the wall did fall, and communism collapsed behind that once seemingly indestructible Iron Curtain. Well, why was Reagan so successful? And Ken has outlined, I think, four very good reasons why, but let me just suggest a couple of other things, sort of to reinforce what Ken has said. Because he concentrated on doing a few things very well and let others worry about who was going to use the tennis court. And yet, he could focus when it counted, as you, I'm sure, will remember very well, Ken, in that very critical period there of the spring and summer of 81 to try to get through the Economic Recovery Act. Ronald Reagan was not disengaged. He was not sitting up there eating tuna fish sandwiches. He was making telephone calls. He was making personal calls. As a matter of fact, I've seen some figures where he was making 200 and 300 personal visits and calls on members of Congress, members of the Senate, reinforcing them, and particularly going after the bollweevils, those Democrats, those Southern Democrats, those moderate conservative Democrats whose votes were needed because the House was Democratic at that point. The Senate was Republican. And President Reagan got engaged when it counted. He also succeeded because he was a genius at building and maintaining coalitions. Able to reach out, get people, work with people, try to get them to look at the bigger picture and not just at their own special interests. He's also a pretty fair speaker, as we will remember. And I think a very important thing, and something that Bob Taft did not have back there in 47 and 48, he could call on a vital conservative movement for ideas, political muscle, and people to run his administration. People like Ken Cribb and Ed Meese and others who are here in this room. Those kinds of people were not available. Certainly were not available to Mr. Eisenhower when he won the presidency and was looking around to staff his administration in 1953. So keep in mind, 48, 81, 82. Now let's look at 95 and 96. The 104th Republican Congress. It's much maligned, and I think unfairly. If we step back, not only did it win with the Contract of America out and out Republican majority, House and Senate, what did it do in terms of specific accomplishments, historic accomplishments? A balanced budget. Now, we conservatives have been talking about a balanced budget for decades. And it finally came about because of Newt Gingrich and the other leaders of that particular Congress. Welfare reform. There wouldn't have been any welfare reform, and there would not be welfare reform today if it were not for that Republican Congress, which forced over two Clinton vetoes, finally, to sign that welfare reform. Part of that was the elimination of the first welfare program, AFDC, since the New Deal. And beyond that, the phasing out of farm subsidies. And yet, as we recall, President Bill Clinton won re-election by running against that Republican Congress in 1996. Harry Truman in 48, Bill Clinton in 1996. Taft in that 80th Congress, Gingrich in the 104th Congress. Very interesting parallels between those two Congresses. What were they? Let me just suggest a few to you. Lessons for us to keep in mind for the future. Both were ruled by hubris. I mean, they just were cocky. They thought they were invincible. Both were more often ideological than prudential. The idea of shutting down the government, that was not a very prudential idea, and they paid dearly for it. Both misjudged the political skills of the president they faced. Dewey sort of dismissing Harry Truman as this Missouri farmer, and Newt Gingrich thinking, well, this is some Arkansas guy that he could take, the guy in the White House. He turned to be a lot more clever than Newt Gingrich. And both took the people for granted. And I think this is one of the things which, there's something intrinsic in the conservative character, perhaps, that we won those victories, but then we took the people for granted. Having won what they considered to be a mandate, Republicans did not think they had to bother communicating what they were doing and why to the public. Ronald Reagan certainly did not make those kinds of mistakes. Let me give you an example, an ancient example, way back in 1948. I made reference earlier to the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan, which, by the way, Bob Taft supported. It's not true, as some people have suggested, that Taft was some, you know, crazy isolationist. He was prudential, and he saw both the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan as necessary measures to take against communism in Europe, and he backed both of those. He tried to cut the Truman Doctrine, appropriations, and also the Marshall Plan, but he voted for final passage, and he said, as a matter of fact, there must be a final vote, and he made sure there was a final vote on the Marshall Plan. There was a prudential politician who understood practical politics. But Harry Truman called Arthur Vandenberg into the White House, into the Oval Office in the fall of 1948. Arthur Vandenberg, the Republican senator from Michigan, someone who had been very much in support of these same measures. And he said, well, Arthur, you know, that's wonderful. The president said we've been able to pass these measures. I certainly think we ought to keep this bipartisan, don't you? We certainly shouldn't get partisan about this in this campaign. We should rise above it, should we not? And Arthur Vandenberg said, that's a wonderful idea, Mr. President. I agree with you. We should be bipartisan. And I certainly am not going to make a partisan issue out of these kinds of issues. And Harry Truman went out the very next day and just blasted the hell out of the 80th Congress as a do-nothing Congress. And Arthur Vandenberg was just, you know, too late caught to try to get the necessary time to rebut and respond to that kind of partisan attack. Let me just finish up with sort of one of the role of ideas. Let me suggest a few things. What were the role of ideas for these three leaders, particularly, that we're talking about here? Taft, Reagan, and Gingrich. Now, Bob Taft was not an intellectual. He was a professional politician, but he was brilliant. He had a brilliant mind, the most brilliant mind of the Senate. He's incisive, analytical, logical, but he was a reader of legislation, not of books. The one document he knew by heart was the U.S. Constitution, and he would not deviate from it. He was also a prudent politician in the tradition of Edmund Burke. For example, when Fred Hartley, who was the House supporter of the Labor Reform Act, wanted to eliminate strikes from their famous labor reform bill, Taft blocked the move, saying, no, workers have a right to strike. And besides, such a provision went too far and would endanger passage of the bill. Ronald Reagan, what about the ideas there? A great reader. A fantastic reader. Ann and I had the opportunity way back in 1965 to visit him in his house in Pacific Palisades, even before he ran for governor. And he went into the kitchen to get some iced tea, and I immediately went over and began looking through his library and pulling out books. And there were bookshelves filled with hundreds of books. I'm wondering, you know, are these fake? Are they real? And I began pulling them out, and they were dog-eared, and they were marked, and they were annotated, and they were filled with his inscriptions. And what were they? They were books of politics, books of economics. Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson was one of them, I recall. The Law by Bastiat was another. Not bad reading for a B family actor down there in Hollywood. And there was one book in particular, two books in particular, which I want to mention, which had an influence. And for our younger scholars here, if you haven't read these, there have been frequent references to one of them, and I think to the other as well, you should go out and get paperback copies and read them tomorrow. The Road to Serfdom by Hayek and Whitaker Chambers Witness. Both of those had a profound impact on Ronald Reagan. Now, I have to, in the interests of truth-telling here, say that I never asked him specifically about this, but I do know that he read not the original 1944 edition of The Road to Serfdom, but the Reader's Digest version of it, which appeared here in 1945 or 46. I never asked him whether he'd read the full version or not, but I think if you go back and read that Reader's Digest version, it's got all the elements in it. And that book stayed with him. There was one other very important conservative politician who also read that same Reader's Digest version, and who referred to it for the rest of his life, and that was Barry Goldwater, who was then a young Arizona businessman. I might also mention that Ronald Reagan was an original subscriber to National Review, Linda, but also equal time, he also was reading Human Events even before he read National Review. He was also, by the way, a member of the Conservative Book Club and read voluminously those. Finally, Newt Gingrich. Well, Newt Gingrich, the problem was he read too much. The Federalist, Peter Drucker, Toffler, et cetera, et cetera. As a story of Newt and the role of ideas, which members of the Congressional Campaign Committee tell when he first came to Washington in the early 80s, he would come over there with an idea and an idea and an idea. He'd come bursting in, maybe just this freshman congressman from Georgia talking about achieving a Republican majority in the House. People thought he was a little bit crazy back in 1980, but of course it happened 1994. But even so, idea after how to come about, wedge ideas, positive ideas, negative ideas. So after a while, they caught on. And years later, they said they would take people over to a corner, and there would be three gigantic metal drawer filing cabinets. Nude ideas, nude ideas, nude ideas, nude ideas. And then way down at the bottom of the third cabinet was one drawer. Good Newt ideas. Apocryphal, I'm not so sure. And yet, Newt Gingrich stood on the shoulders of those who had come before him, and he's openly acknowledged this, Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, and their influence is evident in the contract with America and the other legislative accomplishments of the 104th Congress. Well, given the size of Leviathan, we've been talking a lot about Leviathan today, conservatives, it seems to me, must take the long view, and I think that is what many here in this room have done, have taken the long view. The modern welfare state was not built in a day, and it's not going to be dismantled in a day. And to prevail in politics, it seems to me that you must be prepared to run not a 100-yard dash, but a marathon. But amid all the inevitable ups and downs and the backs and forwards and the advances and the treats, conservatives can take solace from the fact, to paraphrase T.S. Eliot, that in politics there are no permanent victories or defeats. Thank you.